Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the second LSE Merrill Lynch EMU debate. It's a great pleasure and a great honour to be acting as chairman with a small c to one of the great chairmen with a capital C. Paul Volcker has had an outstandingly distinguished career, mainly in the public sector, working in various parts of the federal government for over 30 years. He was at the United States Treasury for 12 years. He was president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, having worked there earlier in his career. He was president until 1979. He then held the post for which he was probably most well known, namely as chairman of the Board of the Governors of the Federal Reserve. That was a post he held from 1979 to 1987. He was appointed by a Democratic president and reappointed by a Republican one. He inherited an inflation rate, I think, of about 13%, and passed on to Alan Greenspan an inflation rate of about 3%. Since 1987, when he ceased to be chairman, he has combined with great distinction activities in the world of commerce, academic life, and in debates on public issues, including a particular interest and concern with the professionalism and effectiveness of public service. He is an alumnus and a great friend of the LSE. He is the honorary chairman of the New York Development Committee, which is responsible for fundraising in the United States. It's wonderful to have him here this evening. He's going to talk about the euro as a global currency, and he has kindly agreed to take questions afterwards. Paul Volcker.
Thank you so much, Alan, for those generous words. You know, there's a certain brotherhood among central bankers, and it's a great pleasure to be introduced by a present central banker. They're all known to speak very modestly about everything, which accounts for the great modesty, I'm sure, of that introduction. Thank you. I have a little feeling I'm here under false pretenses. You know, everybody these days who's at all involved with international financial affairs spends a good part of their time attending seminars or conferences or speeches or whatever on the euro. That's even true in the United States, and it must be true squared in Europe. And so when I was asked by my old friend and mentor, Ann Bohm, to come here and, you know, she said, visit with a few students and talk about the euro, I thought I could take something off the shelf and talk about the euro in a little seminar. This is somewhat larger than the seminars I remember at LSE. And I didn't know it was meant to be a debate, so I've kind of been blindsided from that direction. But then when I realized when I got here it's euro and a global currency, the disappointment is I don't have a special speech about euro as a global currency. I have thought about this matter, and I've thought about it, I've read a lot of this stuff. There are a lot of learned essays, seminar papers, analyses, very careful statistical analyses of how many reserves are going to shift from dollars to euros and what the trading patterns are and how many of them are going to be in euros instead of dollars and what it all means for the strength of the euro. I've looked at some of those papers, but I'm very skeptical that anyone can sit here and project with any degree of accuracy the global dimensions of the euro. I think there's a lot you can say about the euro, but I am rather agnostic about the global dimensions. So anybody that thinks they're going to go from this audience in this speech with a firm idea of the value of the dollar against the euro 6 months from now or 6 years from now, if that's what you think you're going to get, you can leave and leave some more room for the other people to sit down. That's I actually think that that question, the role of the euro in the world, and certainly its value against the dollar or other currencies, is going to be determined by more things, more important things than the mechanics of the euro and how they work out. Now, the basic thing that is going to change currency values is some sense of the basic trend of economies, both the real growth, the innovation, the productivity, the degree of price stability. And even more important than those underlying trends, which don't change very fast, is going to be perceptions of what the trend is. And they can be pretty volatile, but I think they will explain the value of the euro in the exchange markets, and they will explain the value of the euro as a global currency more than anything else. And those questions involve so many variables that if anybody talks about them with great precision, I am very suspicious. I was, that lesson was brought home to me forcibly not so long ago when I went to one conference on the euro, and I think the most brilliant expositor, certainly the most forceful expositor of economic policy in the United States that I know, Fred Bergston, he's always very clear in his analysis, he's always very forceful in presenting it. And when he presents the conclusion that the euro is going to be a wonderful, strong world currency, one is inclined to go from that meeting with faith and confidence. But 3 days later, I went to another conference with another old central banking colleague, which I maybe will not name, but in the center of this argument, and he explained, an ex-central banker, I might say, explained all his concerns about the currency. The euro would be a weak, feeble, unreliable currency, equally persuasively. And I think those two speeches that I heard in such a narrow frame of time fully reflected the uncertainties that exist in this area. Let me just make a few broad conclusions that may be relevant to this question, and then approach it from a somewhat different direction. First of all, the point I already made, I think the value against the dollar, against the yen, against any currency is going to be driven by some basic economic trends that may not be entirely independent of the euro, but they are certainly partly independent of the euro. Let me say, too, that in all this argument over whether the euro is going to become a reserve currency and a real challenge to the dollar, let me make clear that I have had some experience with a reserve currency, and it is not an unalloyed joy. So whether it wins or loses in that kind of narrow sense may not be an important accomplishment or lack of accomplishment for Europe as you move ahead. Let me say, too, in all these analyses I read, there is a tendency to concentrate in a rather elaborate way, sometimes a simplified way, sometimes an elaborate way, is what's going to happen to the euro as a preferred asset within Europe and by countries or individuals outside of Europe. And what strikes me is that if you're going to have an active international currency, it is at least as important as what's going to happen to it as a vehicle for borrowing, as what happens to it as a vehicle for asset holdings. And as a vehicle for borrowing, it may be a source of weakness rather than strength, certainly at times, and both its place as an asset or a borrowing currency can very easily lead to instability rather than stability, one of the things that makes being a reserve requirement not an unalloyed joy. Now, having said that, I think it is almost inevitable, unless it's a complete failure, and I do not believe it will be a failure in any sense, the euro is obviously going to become more important. I think European financial markets will benefit in competitiveness and breadth and liquidity by the development of the euro. But saying that is true does not imply it's a great advantage to Europe as opposed to others who are either depositors or borrowers. It's not a great advantage for European-owned institutions as opposed to American-owned institutions. I don't think Merrill Lynch, for one, has to sit here worrying about whether the euro market develops as a euro market or whether the dollar remains very important in Europe. They'll find a way to make money either way. And I think that will be true of most important financial institutions. Well, with that much introduction of disappointment, let me go back to the beginning in terms of my thinking about the euro. And let me say I have thought the euro was a good idea for a long time, but mainly and primarily for political reasons. When Chancellor Kohl, who's been a great prophet of the euro, thinks about the euro, I'm sure he thinks about it, and I had the pleasure of hearing him again just yesterday in Germany, he thinks about it as an exemplar and leader of European unity, of tying Germany very closely to his neighbors on the European continent. He thinks against the history of war and conflict and bloody war and conflict over the 20th century, and he wants his heritage to be a common currency that will diminish or end that possibility of conflict within Europe. And I don't want to minimize that at all. I think that is, maybe I have enough German blood in me to think that that is a prime purpose of the euro. But in contrast to most American economists, and I know a few skeptics on this side of the Atlantic, I also think it's maybe not an unalloyed joy, but a good idea for more purely economic reasons. I think that is true because I think those who are skeptical or opposed, I think it's a dangerous thing, have a rather idealistic picture of what the alternative is. They argue, of course, as you know, that the implication of the euro is going to be that individual European nations are going to be giving up very critical tools of economic policy. By definition, national monetary decision-making will be not just limited, it will be extinct. There will, by definition, be no possibility of exchange rate adjustments within Europe. Demonstrably, fiscal flexibility is already closely hemmed in, not just in Europe, but almost everywhere, by political forces. And the European-wide stability pact will tend to reduce the degrees of freedom even further. And then, of course, the argument runs that national labor markets are rigid, cross-border labor mobility is extremely difficult, if not absolutely frozen. So, net-net, we have means of national economic adjustment gone. The implication, as some sees it, is that Europe will be doomed for a long time to live with large areas, even whole countries, caught in a trap of sluggish growth, and they're unable to extricate themselves by their own policy instruments. And they instead will have in this view, a vice of German-like monetary policy, fixated on price stability, that simply can't and won't be responsive to differing national needs. Now that's the view. My trouble is that view seems to me to be based, dare I say it in this room, on a pretty textbook or academic picture of the adjustment efficiency of these tools of economic policy that we are talking about, and particularly the efficiency of flexible exchange rates, this kind of vision that when you have a disequilibrium, we can have an orderly, probably gradual movement in exchange rates that might be responding to inflation differentials, but over time productivity differentials, or shocks from outside. It also assumes that fiscal policy can practically and confidently be adjusted with predictable results, even in highly politicized governments, and all our governments are highly politicized. I think it fails to recognize the basic importance of maintaining price stability as a kind of basic element in economic stability and growth for any country. The reality is, and we've seen it in Europe, that exchange rate flexibility can easily degenerate into a kind of instability that creates problems in economic management rather than the reverse, and we certainly see evidence of that in Asia today. Now, Europe has kind of recognized that, has recognized that threat for some years, so that without a common currency, it has decided it wanted to maintain exchange rate stability in a rather rigid form, plus or minus a very small percentage, and until recently, and de facto still plus or minus a very small percentage. It has also increasingly, as many other countries around the world, most countries around the world, attached a high priority to price stability without the single currency. And it has certainly found it difficult, as we all have in almost all countries, found it difficult to adjust fiscal policy sensibly and flexibly in response to changing economic circumstances. I was asked today, in appearing before a committee in the House of Lords, wasn't this a terrible loss? Obviously, ideally, you ought to have coordinated fiscal and monetary policy, and when you create an independent monetary body, such as proposed in Europe, you, by definition, will not find it possible to coordinate fiscal policy with monetary policy. I reminded them we have had great difficulty in coordinating fiscal policy with monetary policy in the United States, where you have at least a single government, and I would dare to say there has been a certain difficulty in coordinated effective monetary and fiscal policies in the UK in those old bad old years in the past when it all came under one authority. And too often, coordination of fiscal and monetary policy has been monetary policy adopting to a loose fiscal policy, which has turned out to be in nobody's benefit. So given that choice, you're better off without the coordination. In any event, we have seen de facto that Europe has, at least the continental Europe, has expended enormous energy in recent years in stabilizing exchange rates with a very considerable amount of success. And when you're looking at the prospects of the euro, I think you first have to ask yourself the question, if that is correct instinct, and certainly it has been repeated for a long time in Europe by different governments, they have thought it is an appropriate and strong national purpose to maintain this exchange rate stability, I think rightly. It is easier to do that by abandoning the possibility of different exchange rates in the first place. If you're going to maintain stability, why leave this temptation for the market to think you might devalue sometime, which makes it harder to maintain a coherent monetary policy or fiscal policy suited to the current economic situation? If you're going to have the stability anyway, let's get rid of the different currencies. And if you want to have a strong emphasis on price stability to support exchange rate stability, why not do that on a European-wide basis? Now, in fact, we've already gone through a decade in which different members of the European Union de facto have found it necessary and by definition desirable to coordinate their monetary policies with the German center. So again, isn't it better as a matter of monetary management to have some voice in what the common monetary policy will be, at least a more direct voice than has been the case during these years. So if you look at what has de facto been happening in Europe, it doesn't seem to me so revolutionary a step to move toward the common currency, and in fact the movement of the common currency will relieve some of the inherent tensions that exist in individual national currencies because of the invitation that they present for speculative attack. Now, what remains is whether the common currency, with all that implies for constraints on national monetary adjustment, is going to help or hurt the prospects for growth. That's obviously the question that concerns people. And I'm not going to argue there's some magic in the common currency that eliminates the possibility of depressed areas. And I think perhaps there's been too little discussion of the opposite side of that coin. When you have the common currency and the common monetary policy, and you are in a country that has a particularly exuberant economic development, you cannot use the monetary tool to restrain the exuberance, and you are going to have to find some other tool or perhaps run the risk of a boom. I mention that because that seems to be the situation in Ireland today. It would be the situation in the UK if you were joining, but you're not joining at the moment. In either case, I would simply point out we have had depressed areas in Europe, not just for years. In southern Italy and elsewhere, we have had depressed areas for decades. We've had it in a context of large fiscal transfers. We've had it in a context of independent fiscal policies. We've had it in the context of independent monetary policies. We've had it in the context of flexible exchange rates. So So don't think you are comparing a situation with a common currency with some kind of nirvana, where astute, careful, deliberate, flexibly adapted official policies conducted by such people as Al and Bud give us freedom from either recurrent booms or recessions. Now, if it's true, and I hear this all the time, and I think there must be some truth to it, that the key problem for Europe is to achieve more flexibility of markets, more incentives to work, more emphasis on innovation, then let's see what happens with the common currency. Will it help or will it hurt? That seems to me the question that ought to be occupying discussions of this area. And it does seem to me the chances are good that the needed changes in structural policy, difficult as they are more likely to take place when you effect remove from the political debate and the economic debate the crutch of devaluation or inflation as alternatives. Let's the population know that there's no escape from these kinds of structural changes. In practice, I think it's true that devaluation can't be an alternative for many individual European countries anyway. It's one thing for an single country to get by with it more or less successfully, as the UK did some years ago. But obviously not every country can devalue against all the other countries, and the benefits are going to be temporary. So you haven't got that alternative freely available to you in any circumstance, in any event. Well, all of that largely deals with the euro and its internal implications. What about the external side? I've already expressed some agnostic feelings about our ability to predict about that. My guess is that so far as the use of the euro in international markets is concerned, there will be some transitional period, almost inevitably, of uncertainty. Uncertainty is going to surround the operations of the new central bank. The underlying European economic situation, I don't think, is so bright or so difficult that it's going to encourage really sizable shifts of official or private liquid assets into a new currency very quickly. And when we look beyond the transitional period, then those fundamental underlying economic forces ought to take hold and be dominant that I referred to at the beginning. I do think that there is every reason to believe a common currency will encourage more competitive, flexible, and liquid financial markets in Europe. So other things being equal, the euro is going to be considered more in a parity with the dollar as a reserve and trading currency. There's a possibility that you'll have a lot of internal stresses, you'll have sluggish growth in Europe. We know you have aging populations, we all do, but yours comes a little quicker than the United States. The cost of social programs are high. You could help lead to a lot of pressures on budgets and deficits. And all of that might raise doubts about the priority given to price stability. If it raises enough doubts, obviously the euro will not be a strong currency. But certainly a lot of protection has been built into the Maastricht Treaty to assure that that is not the case. Will you get a broader economic structuring that will enhance European competitiveness? Well, I come down on the side, it's a big question, but you're more likely to get it with the euro than without. But again, when we're talking about the performance of Europe, you have to consider what the competition is. So we would have to consider what the performance of the United States will be, what its performance will be, what's going on in Japan, a lot of other questions. And I simply don't know the answer to all those questions with any conviction. I do have a feeling that in this life, things are not going to go perfectly smoothly through the years, with or without the euro. They haven't gone smoothly without it. There's no reason to think that doubts, political or economic, aren't going to arise from time to time in the United States and in Japan and even in Europe. And one thing I think we can count on from experience, and that is when these doubts and uncertainties arise, even when they don't seem to be all that well grounded, we know that exchange markets will be prone to exaggerating trends, prone to excesses, prone to herd instincts, prone to moving away from presumed equilibrium for long periods. That textbook model of even major currencies moving in a way gradually consistent with equilibrium in trade and payments and capital simply does not seem to exist empirically. So I think the euro poses, again, an issue as to what we should be doing collectively to deal with that kind of uncertainty in exchange markets and to enhance stability among currencies and markets. Now, in a direct sense, of course, we introduced the euro. The instability of exchange rates within Europe will be gone, and the volatility of financial markets related to different national currencies in Europe will be gone. It's gone by the simple expedient of eliminating the currencies. That's the purpose, of course, of the euro. But the question that I am concerned with is whether the creation of the euro, and let's assume it's successful within Europe with those objectives, will tend to stabilize exchange rates with the rest of the world or not. Stabilize both exchange rates and capital flows across the Atlantic and across the Pacific. Now, you would think, at least the way they used to teach economics to me, that you have two very large continental masses, North America, Europe. You've got the then third biggest economic area, Japan, the three major currencies in the world facing off. You would think with these large industrial countries with more or less the same industrial structure, particularly between North America and Europe, closely competitive, and let's assume they both maintain their current success, which has now been over quite a period of time, toward price stability. You would have all the ingredients of very narrow movements in exchange rates as those currencies move vis-a-vis each other. They all have strong independent central banks, or at least North America and Europe do, so there's a promise of confidence for the future. It's hard to imagine that competitive conditions between Europe and the United States are going to change very rapidly. You know, you might get a 1% difference a year. Even that would be a large difference. It should be relatively predictable. So exchange rates, if they're in any kind of equilibrium, ought to move over a narrow range too. You certainly should if you have firm expectations about where the exchange rate should be. You might have some cyclical fluctuations, but that could all be easily adjusted in all those new derivative markets and all the rest. It's a nice picture, but I really wonder whether it has much more correspondence with reality in the future than the stories that we've heard in the past. You know, we used to hear about how well floating exchange rates were going to work in the 1970s. You only gave them a chance to settle down, and people could learn how to deal with them. I've heard that story for a long time. And here we are, more than 25 years after the introduction of floating exchange rates, and one of the largest episodes of instability is the dollar-yen rate, the two biggest existing economies moving up and down, by more than 50% over the course of 3 years. Something, and they both essentially have stable prices, similar economies. Now, my sense is that the new European Central Bank and the European fiscal authorities as well are inevitably going to be faced with internal challenges and tensions. Will they not be as indifferent to the euro, the external exchange rate of the euro, as has been often the case with the United States? What we know is that trade external to Europe, if not quite de minimis, will be much less important than foreign trade has been to individual European countries in the past. And it will be very similar to the United States, where about 10% of our GNP is imported or exported. There's an interesting, I might mention, ambiguity in the Maastricht Treaty as to who should be concerned with that. There's a section which points to the ability of the political authorities to give some general orientation for exchange rates, which makes me think somebody has at least thought about this problem. But when I ask my European friends what it means, I don't get very clear answers. What I can well imagine is that authorities on both sides of the Atlantic will not wish to commit their prestige, their policy, or their resources to stabilizing exchange rates, which is a matter that doesn't have much of a political constituency. In fact, there are a lot of people in markets that live off this instability and are positively opposed to stabilizing. Now, if markets sense that governments and central banks are neglectful of the desirability of exchange rate stability, I think you have a climate where huge amounts of capital could easily be mobilized to ride a trend. And when you have two main centers of economic power, Europe and the United States, it may be even more difficult to find a forum and a focus for international decision making. More difficult even than in the past to achieve a political consensus. You have two main powers, it's a good recipe for an impasse. And not only an impasse between those two powers, when I consider the inherent strength of Europe, the inherent strength of the United States, the strength and pride of Japan, think of some institution, let's call it the IMF, which purports to represent the wider interests of the international community. What are the chances of them imposing stabilizing actions on the main actors in international financial markets? The chronic difficulty of managing fiscal policy at all flexibly certainly is not going to be changed by the introduction of the euro. Now, we can take some comfort, and a lot of people would take comfort, I suppose, in the thought that even if concerns about the instability in the dollar, euro, yen exchange rates are borne out, we'll be better off than we are now when we have the potential for instability among a lot of different European currencies. And I think there's something to that if we look at the exchange rate system in isolation. But I don't think we can say the situation would be ideal, far from it. And I want to, a little bit later, explore the implications of that for some of the more fragile emerging economies. I haven't got time to talk about the Asian financial crisis at any length, but I can't resist a few ad hoc comments. And the first comment I would make is that I do not view this so-called Asian crisis as an Asian crisis. It has strong parallels with what happened in Mexico only 3 years ago. It is very similar in many of its characteristics to what happened to the Czech Republic only last year, and the threat and instability that has existed elsewhere in Eastern and Central Europe. We have lots of evidence that smaller emerging economies have been subjected to extreme instability, even when in particular cases they have been considered to be doing a very good job at macroeconomic policy. It is almost embarrassing to read the World Bank and Fund reports last June and last August going out of their way to praise the macroeconomic policies of Indonesia. And the fact is that these countries that were perceived to have constructive and effective macroeconomic policies were precisely the countries, I include the Czech Republic in that, just to take an example from this part of the world, are the countries that attracted the most volatile short-term capital and suffered the most from the sudden reversal in those capital flows. We live in a world where there is much more liquid capital ready to move very quickly around the world, and those masses of capital are out of proportion with the size of small emerging economies with small and, in that respect, inherently fragile banking systems. People don't quite realize that a banking system in Indonesia, a country of 200 million people, is barely the size of one good-sized regional bank in the United States. The total banking system in Argentina, a relatively well-developed country, is about $50 billion. And there are not many respectable banks in the United States that consider $50 billion as a viable total, even in our relatively steady country. It's no wonder they get overwhelmed by volatile flows of international capital. Small economies with inevitably small financial systems simply get overwhelmed. And the financial crises, when you have a lot of impact on exchange rates and interest rates, quickly turn into serious economic crises. And there's no wonder the IMF has had trouble responding to this question, because it is a systemic question, I think, of a kind that is inherent in this new financial world that we have invented, of very large flows of capital, individual investment institutions that are larger than the whole economy of Indonesia. Creates a certain vulnerability. I must say, just to illustrate the nature of the problem, I'm a bit bemused by some of the response. It is quite common to hear, well, with the trouble in Thailand, or the trouble in Malaysia, the trouble in the Philippines, the trouble in Indonesia, was that they did not handle their exchange rate with sufficient flexibility. And if they'd only let them float or move a little bit, maybe this crisis could have been avoided. And the very next paragraph for the very same speaker will say, it is absolutely vital that Hong Kong maintain its fixed parity down to the last penny, or the whole of Asia will be jeopardized. And of course, if China doesn't maintain a fixed exchange rate, it's a matter of concern for the whole world. Well, if we can't even make up our mind as to what the right exchange rate policy is for small countries in Asia, I think we're in a little difficulty about the nature of the exchange rates system. I mean, quite fundamentally, it seems to be fatuous nonsense, I love that phrase, to lecture small emerging economies about their exchange rate policies when the two biggest economies of the world, upon which they are dependent, have had in the last 3 years fluctuations in their exchange rate of 50 or 60%. Where is Indonesia supposed to put its exchange rate? Is it supposed to go to with Japan and face a appreciation against the dollar of 50% 2 years ago, only to have a decline by 60% 2 years later? Does it go with the dollar, which everybody says was a terrible thing they did, and have a depreciation of 50% 2 years ago and appreciation of 60% this year? Or is it a wonderful policy to go right in between and say they're going to be 30% off against the dollar and 30% off against the yen? I mean, you know, there's no correct, I would submit to you, exchange rate policy under that condition, under those conditions, for small countries more heavily exposed to external influence by far than these big gorillas in the international financial market, when the big gorillas have as much instability among themselves as been demonstrably the case, not just in those past few years, but for some period of time. Without going into more detail than we have time for at the moment, it seems to me the basic economic force faced with this kind of instability is toward more integration rather than less. These countries will survive with some degree of stability and grow if they accept the fact that in a quite specific way their financial system will have to be part of much bigger companies. And Merrill Lynch will have to buy their investment banks, and Chase Manhattan or NatWest or somebody will buy their commercial banks. And when you have a big enough institution, this tendency toward instability can be withstood to some extent. And we see that happening. There is one privately owned commercial bank of any size left in Argentina that is not foreign owned or controlled. Four out of the biggest five commercial banks in Mexico today, after the crisis, are owned or substantially influenced by foreign ownership. That is a country that only 5 years ago violently protested during the NAFTA arrangements that they needed to make special exceptions for foreign investment for commercial banks because they wanted all their commercial banks Mexican owned. Four out of the biggest five banks in Hungary are foreign owned. Thailand, 6 months ago, said they didn't want a foreign owned commercial bank or financial institution. They now say, please come and buy us. And I think that is a correct institutional response for stability. And it's not just limited to the financial system. How sustainable it is politically and otherwise, I don't know. But I think the same tendency will take place in the exchange markets. They will have to, in the effort to get more stability, develop regional arrangements that will kind of give islands of stability around the world. That is what you see at work in Europe. And the influence of the euro will go beyond the particular countries that happen to be members of the euro. That is what you see potentially and actually in the Americas. In Asia, it's much harder, where the trade is more diversified. And they're not going to have a harder time searching for regional stability, but I am sure one thing, they are going to search. Is this a good or a bad thing for the world? In the short run, it may be good. It may produce more stability. In the long run, I worry about it. Will we tend to be fostering some big regional areas in the world that not only will become more competitive and potentially antagonistic in trade, but in a very broad sense, become antagonistic politically? And you will lose the central thrust of trade policy and financial policy in the post-war world toward multilateralism. Well, I hope that threat does not materialize, but I think the development of the euro and the external dimensions of the euro are one symptom of what's going on in the world more broadly. At the very least, it seems to me there is a silver lining in this Asian crisis. For the first time in a long time, I have seen people actually willing to discuss the exchange rate system and what might be done about it. And I don't mean to suggest that I am so foolishly optimistic to say there's any going to be any great reform in the short run. But I do count it as a bit of an advance in thinking that at least it is respectable to raise the subject and to talk about it, not just within Europe, but among all the areas of the world. So I think that's another little benefit from what we see going on in Europe, and a slight side benefit from what is otherwise a very serious crisis in Asia. Thank you very much. Well, I have droned on a little more than expected, but you can have all sorts of opportunities to attack me, because it's supposed to be a debate.
So there are roving microphones around. Paul Volk is going to catch your eye, so he will call
questions or
speakers, but please wait until the microphone reaches you.
Okay. Who wants to start?
Oh, you're the microphone man, eh?
Yeah. Okay, at the back there.
Would the dollar benefit from an international monetary system in which the euro would play an increasingly important role alongside the dollar?
I think it's neutral. I got a kind of classic view on this. I don't think we need to worry about the role of the dollar in the United States. My worry is the one I expressed, that the combination of the two may lead to more neglect of the exchange rate than we now have, and we'll have more volatility rather than less, and that's not, I think, in the long run American interest. I don't think it's in the long run European interest, but whether it is so powerful in the fact that anybody wants to do anything about it is a major question. I think the difficulty is very insidious. It's not that the American economy is going to benefit or be hurt in the short run or very visibly at any time. But if you want a one-world economy, you want it open, you're worried about keeping trade open and continuing that momentum, keeping international capital markets open, I don't think incentives toward regional currency or trading developments are a plus. I think they're a minus.
Mr. Volker, you referred in your earlier remarks that possibly the aim of Chancellor Kohl in pushing forth for a European Monetary Union and a euro is ultimately political, in forming possibly a federal state in Europe. Now, if that is the case, and presumably that will result in a formation of a common foreign and defense policy, what is the likelihood then that that could ultimately result in conflict with the United States and rivaling the United States, in fact, and weakening of United States influence in Europe with its implications in NATO, etc.?
Well, your question leads me beyond where I want to go. I said Chancellor Kohl was interested in a common currency. I did not say he was interested in a federal Europe, which I understand has quite a different definition on the continent than it does here. And the definition is kind of opposite. So I don't want to get into all those implications. But I do think there is, as I'm repeating myself, there's some danger that the economic tendency is towards separation over a period of time, which I don't think is a good idea. I don't know that I should tell this story, but I was at a conference in Berlin. Among the foreign policy types in the United States, there was much griping about their inability to get a consistent policy from Europe. And they were worried about Bosnia and all the other places where Europe has been relatively impotent. And they said, we need a telephone number. Who do we call in Europe to get their assistance? Tell us what your telephone number is. And all I didn't enter into this debate, but all I could think back in the old days when I was negotiating for the United States Treasury, I was delighted that there were a bunch of individual European countries and there was no telephone number to call, because I thought that meant at least we could find one European country on our side. But times change.
This is somewhat similar to the question asked earlier. How do you think when the euro is stable, it will affect the investment funds into the US, given that more people will be likely to keep their deposits denominated in euro instead of, for example, the US dollar?
Well, if the euro is successful in price stability, successful in achieving better growth than it's achieved so far in this decade, and if the United States economic performance is not outstanding, I presume there will be some diversification of reserve holdings. I also presume there will be some diversification of borrowing, as I said. And how this comes out in terms of strength of the currencies remains to be seen. There seems to be some implicit assumption that being a reserve currency is a great thing and it leads to a strong currency. And the United States has been the great reserve currency in the post-war period, and the dollar's done nothing in the long-term trend but depreciate against the European currencies in the yen. So there's no correlation between those two functions, and in fact there's some danger in being a reserve currency and in undermining the value of your currency. We used to say to be a reserve currency when international capital flows weren't so great, you had to run a deficit, a current account deficit all the time, which is not a recipe for necessary long-term strength and stability. But my concern is that with these two competing large currency areas, whatever the relative number of dollars or euro there are in reserves, there could be more instability rather than less between the two areas, obviously not within Europe.
Do you have any thoughts on how the potential millennium bug will affect the short-term stability on the euro?
No. I do. Like many other people, I'm a director of some companies that worry about the millennium. I am so computer illiterate, I still do not understand why this is such a great problem. But I am told that this is a great problem. It's embedded in every computer chip in the world. But I can only report a feeling. There is some concern on the part of large American financial institutions that they are ahead of the European institutions in making the necessary adjustments, and the European institutions may be in a bit of trouble when December 31st, 1999 comes around. Now, that's all I can tell you, and I don't think it has much bearing on this long-range question. Right?
We take a question. Yes, there's two questions down there. Gentleman sitting on the floor.
Mr. Walker, do you think the whole world depends too much on the dollar, as in borrowing, and it is a currency in which the exchange market operates on? Do you think there's too much dependence on this currency, and maybe the euro is a good idea to bring in?
Well, if you're going to depend upon a currency, I'd love it to be the dollar. I mean, I'm a patriot or something, but I keep coming back to the same answer. I think whether the euro is a plus or a minus in this arena just depends too much on factors which I can't predict any better than you can. You tell me what the rate of productivity growth is going to be in Europe in the next 10 years. You tell me what the rate of inflation is going to be in the next 10 years in Europe. And you tell me what it's going to be in the United States and how much innovation there's going to be and whether we're going to have civil conflict in either of those countries or, you know, prime ministers assassinated or whatever. Then I'll tell you which currency I think is better and which one will be more stable. But what I worry about is that it will create more instability, not that one will, transatlantic instability, not that one will win in some sense and the other lose. You know, in looking at people worry about senior age and whether the United States is getting a free ride, the basic source of senior age in a monetary sense is the number of dollar bills that people use outside of, $100 bills that they use outside of the United States, which is basically an interest-free loan to the United States. And that's big. I mean, nobody knows how big, but say it's a couple $100 billion, which a lot of people think. So we get, 4% interest or something, 5% interest we save. It's $8 or $10 billion a year, which is not insignificant. But it's not enough to make the world go round and say this is something you're going to, you know, manipulate your economy to get people to hold more of your currency abroad. And in that area, I think the United States is so far ahead, for better or worse, it will take a very long time for Europe to catch up.
This may be inviting more indiscretions, but as we didn't say very much about sterling, could I ask you perhaps to make some comments about how you see the implications for sterling and the British economy of not joining the euro?
Well, my impression is the British economy is doing obviously well and doing better than other European countries, and I think that is a genuine reason to be hesitant about the timing. If you look at all of Europe, with some much more minor exceptions, and just in quantitative terms like Ireland, the conditions happen to be cyclically pretty much in tune. They've all got low inflation. They've all got too high unemployment, which isn't good, but at least it's consistent. They all have relatively sluggish growth and may be improving. So it's a reasonable starting point, I think, for the common currency. Now, of course, that's partly a function. They've had their currencies locked together already. So I think, in that sense, I think it's fair to say they are better prepared to go ahead right now and probably about as well prepared as you could ever be. I mean, it really is a remarkable convergence of basic economic trends. I don't know if they've ever seen it before, that the economic trends in Europe are outside of the UK and outside of Ireland, perhaps, are so close together. So in that sense, you know, you could understand that cyclically, this is not the time, ideal time, to say the least, for sterling to join in. I do think, you know, people ask, what difference does it make if you're out? Will that hurt? I doubt if it hurts London in the short run, because as a financial center, because that is so well equipped and they deal in good foreign currencies anyway, they might as well deal in the euro as well as the dollar, and a lot of expertise in computers and space and all the rest that you know about. I do think that a foreign company, a manufacturing company, or a service company that is deciding about where to invest in Europe, he's going to have a lot of considerations in mind, but one of his considerations is going to be, do I want to put my plant, I want to produce for all of Europe, do I put my plant someplace where there's 200 million people and a stable exchange rate among them, or do I put my plant in some place where there are 50 million people with the prospect of a rather unstable exchange rate and selling to the other 200 million? I think the answer to that's obvious. And I think it's a rather strong incentive to think pretty hard about where you want to go in the longer run.
Mr. Volcker, what, based on your experience at the Fed, what advice would you give the new governor of the European Central Bank?
The new governor of the European Central Bank? Let me give one advice that's consistent with my experience at the Federal Reserve. He's starting off in a favorable condition, but he's got price stability or close to it. He's got a reasonable consistency in the trends around Europe. So he may not, in that sense, face any terribly critical policy. There's already a lot of convergence in interest rates. What his problem will be is enhancing understanding of policy and credibility in that sense, and I think that will be a very big challenge, because conditions will diverge around Europe from time to time. and establishing the credibility of the bank, not just as a price stability machine, but as a competent institution, professional, independent of partisan political pressures, an institution that can communicate with the public as best a central bank can and get some understanding of what its role and function is, even though some areas of the community are not doing so well, that will be his big challenge, getting that firmly embedded in the traditions of the bank and the thinking of Europeans. And central banks individually, I think, are going a pretty long ways in that direction in recent years, but he's got the new challenge of doing it on a continent-wide basis, which isn't going to be so easy.
Mr. Volcker, EMU is a wonderful dream, but it's a project 25 years ahead of its time.
Where are we here?
The single currency in the United States works very well because it has three key attributes. It has had 150 years for the various economies of the different states to converge. It has a common language. If you're unemployed in New York, you can get a job in San Francisco and vice versa. Thirdly, there are large fiscal transfers between the various states, between the rich and the poor. Europe has none of those attributes. The system has been cobbled together in the last few years. There is no common language. An unemployed Welshman is not going to get a job in Italy, or a Spaniard in Denmark. And thirdly, the system for fiscal transfers is not large enough. Do you think that the system will survive a serious downturn in 5 years' time? Will it not come apart at the edges?
Well, I'm inclined to make a few observations in response, including the fact that in a few years, many Americans are going to be speaking Spanish as English as the rate that we're going. But and your question implies somehow that the dollar sprung up as a national currency last year after 150 years of history. The dollar was a national currency in 1783, anyway, or 1793, when it's very hard to argue that conditions were, you know, exactly the same in New York as they were in Kansas, and California hadn't been discovered yet. And there was a lot of conflict in the United States. The history of the United States in the 19th century is filled with political conflict of a monetary character, that these guys running monetary policy in New York, de facto, before a central bank, were not sensitive to the needs of cotton farmers in South Carolina. And probably was true. But you did have a common currency, and I don't think it's the reason we had the Civil War. But I guess maybe some historians have argued that. I'm sure you're exaggerating the amount of fiscal transfers. The principal fiscal stabilizer, to the extent it exists, is the automatic stabilizer these days in the United States. Nobody has much confidence anymore in discretionary fiscal policy, and even if they had confidence, you've got an impossible job of getting it enacted. When is the last time the United States enacted a flexible fiscal policy for economic stabilization purposes? I can't remember. I mean, the last attempt that I can remember offhand was during the Vietnam War in 1967 or 1968. We certainly did not have a great stabilizing fiscal policy in the 1980s. That was beautifully consistent with monetary policy. Since then, we've had a kind of steady policy of gradually restoring balance, but it has not been cyclically sensitive. We've been cutting down on welfare transfers and that kind of thing that shifts from rich to poor. The automatic stabilizer is still there. It's still there in Europe. The revenues will go up and down unless it's constricted too much by the stability pact. But I think this business is, you know, it's more an economic model than reality. Europe has a much bigger government expenditures relative to the economy than the United States, which gives a certain cyclical responsiveness just automatically, and a certain stability. So I think you have overdrawn these contrasts. There is more labor mobility in the United States. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But I suggest you look at Argentina. That's my favorite example now because it happens to fit in very nicely. Here's a country with a terrible economic history, low productivity, inflation, hyperinflation, nothing going on, big unemployment, very strong labor unions, labor rigidities, you name it, worse than I can think of in any European country. Now, they introduced a common, they had an extreme crisis, so they had the right background for making a change, but they said, we're going to fix the exchange rate. We're really going to fix it. We're going to adopt, basically, we're going to have a parallel currency called the dollar, and we're going to make it very difficult to change it. And, you know, marvelous to say, here we are 5 years later, Argentina has the greatest growth and productivity they've had. They are, by most descriptions, more competitive than they've been within memory. They went through a high period of unemployment, which is now going down, but the growth rate is, I guess, been on a sustained basis higher than any place else in Latin America during the 1990s, and they have no labor mobility. I mean, they may have a little bit in Argentina, but it's not a very big country, but they have they don't have substantial immigration or the reverse. So that is the kind of thing you would hope would happen in Europe, I mean, in less dramatic form. But they took away the ability to devalue, they took away the independent monetary policy, and they've done a lot of structural adjustment. And the economy's done better. Now, maybe there are other, it's a very nice example because it fits in with my predilections. And there may be some other factors at work, but I think it is not insignificant.
I think we have time for two more questions. So I'm going to take one from upstairs and one from downstairs. So does someone have a microphone already?
We've got downstairs here.
And then I'll just take the upstairs one first.
Yeah.
With regard to the fiscal responsibility that's going to be required to make the euro work, what kind of enforcement do you think needs to be among the European countries in order to either coordinate or at least prevent irresponsibility on the fiscal side?
Well, they've already got a strong effort in that direction in the Stability Pact, and I don't know all the ins and outs of the Stability Pact. My impression is that could be awkward in some circumstances if the economy is depressed, in particular countries or in Europe generally, because against history, it's a pretty tight criteria. I know there's language that can be suspended, whether that can work flexibly enough, but I would think to make the euro work well, the fiscal policy work well within the context of the common currency, all the countries, the typical work a little harder. I'm not even sure they have to work harder, but they ought to be able to achieve a balanced budget in a normal cyclical situation. Most of them have deficits now, but they also have a lot of unemployment. And they may be able to achieve the same thing that we've achieved at the moment anyway in the United States, and hope we can hang on to it, that in at least in a high employment circumstance, you run a balance and a surplus. And then even the Stability Pact, allows the possibility you could have a deficit when circumstances seem to require a deficit, or the automatic stabilizer as it works. So I suspect there's a little more to be done on fiscal policy over a period of time without being overly restrictive right at the moment when the economy still need to get some little stronger momentum.
Given that longer term, the pound sterling would probably not be able to remain on its own, what would your view be on the British and the Irish seeking to confederate with the United States and adopting the dollar?
I think that's a little beyond my mandate today, but I would, I think it's beyond my mandate today. I will stop. We got a lot of Irish in the United States already. I just, my office is on Fifth Avenue, and last Thursday we had the St. Patrick's Day parade. I thought all of Ireland was in the United States. That's
okay, thanks very much. I've been asked to make two housekeeping announcements before I thank Paul Volcker. The first is that when we leave, would you kindly let us leave first? We don't want an undignified scramble as we try to leave, though I suspect that Paul Volcker would do rather better in an undignified scramble than I would. So that's the first point. And the second is that with those who've been invited to the reception should make their way, again, in a calm and dignified manner, to the fifth floor. Well, I think that this is the most crowded I have ever seen the old theatre. And since I also assume that this is a vacation, that makes it all the more extraordinary. And that's a great tribute
to the respect in which Paul Volcker is held and shows how eager people are to hear what he has to say. And we certainly haven't been disappointed. Paul Volcker has shown his great skills as a public speaker with his ability to distill the core of the argument from the surrounding confusion. Usually when I listen to people debating EMU, I find myself disagreeing violently with whoever I've just heard, regardless of which side they're on. And I believe that Paul Volcker is a rare exception to that general rule, and that's because he presents the arguments in such a fair and balanced way that they command our full attention and respect. We've also heard and seen his great ability to survey and comment on international issues in that unmistakably robust way that he has on the basis of his great wisdom and his experience gained through a long career. It's been a privilege to listen to him, and we're most grateful. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.